What does it mean to experience a deadly epidemic?
In recent months, people have struggled with this question, but it's not a new question. Welcome to Experiencing Epidemics podcast. We are Gaspar Jakovac,
Jorge Diaz Ceballos,
and Ian Hathaway, and we want to explore this question as historians by delving into personal narratives drawn from the long history of people's encounters with epidemics.
We do so thanks to the contributions of scholars based at the European University Institute and beyond.
This project is brought to you as part of the COVID-19 Knowledge Hub of the European University Institute. Enjoy the show.
Hello everyone, this is Ian Hathaway speaking, and welcome to episode number 5 of Experiencing Epidemics podcast. Today, we will be speaking about a fascinating 18th century book written by Michel Ranft. Now, Ranft was a Lutheran clergyman born in Saxony in 1700. He is mainly known for writing this book on vampires, the title of which is De Masticatione Mortuorum in Tumulis, or Concerning the Dead Who Chew in Their Graves. We will have a chance to listen to several incredible excerpts from this text today. The book itself was first published as a Latin dissertation in the 1720s, and finally largely expanded in German in 1735, with an interesting subtitle, The True Nature of the Hungarian Vampires and Bloodsuckers. In this book, Ranft tackles popular beliefs about unresting corpses and epidemics through the learned frames of theology and medicine. And to discuss the cultural connections between vampires and epidemics, we are joined today by Dr. Anton Serdechny. Anton holds a doctorate in history from the École Pratique des Hautes Études in Paris. After teaching early modern history in Marne-les-Vallées, Neuchâtel, Moscow, and Aix-Marseille, he is currently a visiting researcher at the European University Institute in Florence. His work focuses on the interactions of religion, culture, and science, and particularly on the links between oral ritual culture and early modern medicine. He is the author of a book, Du Tabac pour la Mort, 2018, which argues that the development of resuscitation techniques in the 18th century was an involuntary scholarly reworking of carnival rites and oral representations of resuscitation. Hello, Anton. Thank you for being with us today. It's a pleasure having you.
Well, the pleasure is mutual. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Now, our listeners might not know this, but they are actually already quite familiar with your work, as you, besides being a historian, are also a musician and have composed and performed all of the music on our show.
It was a great pleasure and adventure to try to do the music for your show, and I'm grateful for that. But I'm also very excited to speak about vampires.
Vampires, yes. So when you first came up with the topic for this episode, I was surprised in a very good way. But why did you choose to focus on this theme?
Well, contrary to what could be expected, there is still much to be established and investigated about European vampiric phenomena in early modern times. One of the relatively patent points of this phenomena lies in the multiple links between vampirism and epidemics, links that are also related to major changes of the frontiers between science and the supernatural.
Right, and I'm sure we'll learn a great deal about this topic in the next 20 minutes or so. But today, you're going to focus on a specific element of, let's say, popular folklore, correct? The chewing dead, or the dead who chew. Who or what were these creatures?
Surely in Germany, Poland, and Bohemia, but most likely in a larger area that might have arrived all the way to Venice. These dead wood chew were actually thought to be some kind of vampires. They not only chewed, but also bothered the living and could even cause death. This was an old belief in Bohemia in the 14th century, just before the Black Death. We find reports like one of a witch named Brodka, or Brudka, who after a certain death appeared to the living, tormenting and killing some of them. The villagers exhumed her body and saw that her shroud had been half eaten. Supposedly, the villagers put a stake through her heart and reburied her. But even this was not enough to stop Brodka from returning. She had to be dug up again and burned.
Well, that's quite the story, I gotta say. Do we know anything more about these so-called vampires from popular lore?
Well, to begin with, we can listen directly to Ranft enumerate the characteristics of the creatures according to local beliefs and learned medical frameworks, including the Paracelsian heritage.
For a long time now, our fathers and mothers have been telling us stories of the dead who chew in the grave, but we thought it dishonorable to believe these tales and fables worthy of Aesop, which impress only the little old women. Our reasons are easy to understand. We have not seen these devouring dead with our own eyes. Our logical thinking has no chance to understand this phenomenon, and the thing we fear most of all, more so than the bite of dogs or snakes, is to be accused of being superstitious. It will be easy for us to expose and justify the phenomena that are generally observed through the system of the astral body on those who are called the chewing dead. This is what the absence of the composition of the corpse, the growth of hair, the renewal of the skin, the growth of nails, the bleeding of the heart, the erection of the penis, and all the rest, if we look at the only Hungarian example, proceed from. We must now explain all that seems to us worthy of mention in the physical world about this chewing of the dead. But before making any assertions, we must eradicate the errors which human superstition has connected to this prodigy, either by preconceived opinion or by misguided imagination. Five opinions concern us here. These are: 1. That these dead chew by making sounds with their mouths. 2. That they devour their shroud with their own mouth. 3. That they are mostly female. 4. That they appear only in times of plague. 5. That they cause the death only of their relatives.
Interesting. So the creatures described by Ranft seem to be quite different from what we have now got used to seeing in movies and television, for example.
Well, you're right there. If I could give you an advice, it would be not to use topoi and techniques from the movies if you do encounter a vampire.
So no sunlight and garlic, I should think.
Absolutely not. No. Real vampires, that is, the ones people actually believed in, are not pale and thin. They're red and puffed up with the blood they have eaten. and the daylight is no problem to them. They can absolutely attack you at noon. Also, the steak is never enough to kill them. And I must add that you can be cured, at least temporarily, once you've been bitten. Just have to take some blood from the vampire and make some bread with it, and if you eat it, you will be fine.
So, where do our modern ideas about vampires come from?
In the late 18th century, we've got another construction which is linked to Gothic-style literature. And there we have this romantic representation of the dead, which is ghostly, emaciated, pale, and aristocratic. And this comes partly from a new link between the figure of noble persons as social vampires. But anyway, this is another story and it belongs to the history of literature. With Ranft, we are much closer to actual beliefs from the Middle and Eastern Europa.
I see, yes. So, in the passage that we just listened to, and indeed in some of the ones we will listen to later, Ranft repeatedly condemns superstition. I found this quite striking, and I was wondering if you could explain some of the context surrounding his distaste for superstitions.
Well, certainly. I guess there were two major reasons. The first being the accusations from Protestants of Catholic being superstitious. And a Protestant like Ranft cannot run the risk of looking like a superstitious person. And the second point is that this risk was exacerbated within the context of development of what we call now Enlightenment. In the 18th century, superstition was one of the worst things you could fall for with fanaticism. Hence, I guess, Ranft's care for dissociate himself from such possible accusations.
And how would you classify the historical beliefs about vampirism that Ranft talks about? Were they superstition?
Well, first of all, I would not use this word because it was very much connotated at that time. This is something that belongs only to the people. Superstition means something that lives on and shouldn't live on. Well, actually, it was very much alive, and it was not only for the people, the common people. So my answer would be that it was a preternatural phenomenon, taken very seriously in the 17th century and the early 18th century.
And what does preternatural mean?
Well, that would be a phenomenon between the natural and the supernatural. That is something we don't use nowadays, a concept we don't use so much.
I see, okay. So what were these preternatural beliefs more specifically?
Many believed at that time that some of the dead did not rest still in their grave, but rather started chewing and munching whatever was around them, starting with their shroud. We do have many accounts from the early modern times of people having heard the dead chewing, making a noise very similar to a pig eating.
All right, so now I have to ask, was there any truth behind these preternatural phenomenon?
Well, no, the whole thing was a factoid, by which I mean something that was very seriously considered as a fact, but was completely unreal, imaginary. Some historians or writers have argued that this factoid was actually based on cases of people being buried alive. But this does not really hold up. The accounts of the dead would chew, don't stop at the noise, but go on far into the fantastic and the horrific.
Anton, these sources are absolutely fascinating, but I am still wondering, what is the connection? What was the connection in this body of popular belief between vampirism and plague?
Well, in the late 1340s, the Great Plague came to Europe. At that time, groups such as Muslims lepers, Jews, and witches were accused of spreading the epidemic at its beginning. However, soon the shroud-eating vampires like Brodka were also linked to the Black Death, at least in some mainly Slavic and Germanic areas. So went the belief. When the dead shall eat their veil, then the pestilence will grow, starting first with the close family of the deceased. So to end the plague, one had to stop the unholy, unpeaceful corpses that chewed, mainly by killing them a second time, by impalement, decapitation, and or burning. Burning is the best, by the way. It always works.
Well, that's a good thing to know, just in case. So if I follow you, vampires could be at the same time the cause and perhaps the solution of an epidemic. What do you make of these popular beliefs, though? Where do you think they came from?
Well, in the 14th century and even later, blaming a disease outbreak, not just of plague, on lepers, non-Christians, conspiracies of witches, and even the dead would chew, were all ways of feeling in control vis-à-vis the epidemic. It may seem strange to 21st century eyes, but these ideas were about understanding and even, in a way, rationalizing disease, at least in the sense of finding the logic behind it, find its cause.
This connection between vampirism and plague that we have been talking about seems to have been a long-standing one in European popular culture. It lasted, from what I gather, perhaps even some 500 years. Now that's a very long time, and I wonder if there were any major changes in the belief throughout its long history.
Yes, of course, there were changes in these beliefs. For example, by the end of the 17th century, the role played by witches in this phenomenon diminished significantly. To simplify, witch hunts became rare and even more rarely sanctioned by official powers. In the meantime, Protestantism has been developing, and by the second half of the 17th century, Protestant culture showed an increased interest for the medical phenomena surrounding death, mainly due to the fact that Protestants, differently from Catholics, did not have, for the most part, codified means of acting in favor of the dead through prayers or other actions, because they considered their fate to be already predestined. You could not help the dead to go to heaven with performing masses, for instance, and to simplify. So, this interest in death also involved discussions about the dead would chew. And little by little, Protestant scholars and clergy started to think of this factoid in a different way. In 1679, for example, Philip Hoar published a small dissertation denying the direct link between the plague and the chewing activity, attributing the mastication to both physical and theological causes, first of all, to the devil.
I assume this is where Michael Ramft, the author of the text from which we have been hearing excerpts, comes in, right?
Yes, Ramft became a real authority on the matter, partly because soon after the first editions of his dissertation in Latin, there was a vampirism outbreak at the border of the Holy Roman Empire and the Ottoman Empire.
I'm sorry, a vampirism outbreak?
Well, so claim some sources. The story goes roughly like this. After the death of a Serbian villager named Peter, his corpse was seen by the living, and 9 people died from disease in 8 days. One military officer witnessed what happened next, and provided an official account of the exhumation of a very spooky corpse. The corpse thought to be a vampire, and the word appears in German at this occasion. So, this corpse had not decayed at all. Its skin, hair, and nails had fallen to give place to brand new ones, and when the stake was put through his body, he manifested a strong erection.
Well, that's definitely not your everyday vampirism account. But what did Ramft make of this tale?
Hans' perspective was characterized by a withdrawal from the supernatural, as was widespread amongst scholars, both Catholic and Protestant. Hans does not deny that the devil may have played a role in the episode, but he firmly contests the idea of the corpse chewing. His goal is to explain the phenomenon by natural means only, though what he means by natural is quite different from what it means today.
If we are to tell the truth, we believe that the infernal noises of these kind are mostly born of superstitious opinion or abused imagination. As the perception of the pleasant and the unpleasant has been granted to all by nature, the magical operation of another body which is performed by the effluvium can easily be felt and received. We send the admirable effects through the sympathetic affections because bodies by nature are inclined to receive in themselves what is the very aim of the magical operation. Thus, if a witch, full of hatred, directs her gaze towards a child, with the very firm intention of bewitching him, the child is immediately bewitched. That which escapes all human intervention, such as the magnetic attraction of iron, is strictly speaking natural magic. That which is brought about by the occult techniques of men, through cooperation with nature, was given the name of artificial magic, even though it is fundamentally natural. We propose to demonstrate that it is possible to contract perfectly imaginary illness that can lead to death, and then we will establish that the victims of this kind of death sometimes perform magical operations on the living. Poisons of the imagination are felt by men especially in times of plague. If this plague is born out of the putrefaction of the human body, it is nevertheless nourished and propagated by fear. Thus, the constitution of the whole man carries death in his limbs even before he is truly affected by it.
Once again, Hans denounces superstitions firmly. He also denied that the dead would chew cause the plague directly, and even denied the mastication itself, explaining it mostly as an hallucination. In sum, he turns to what would appear nowadays to be a psychological explanation. The fear, for instance, of epidemic and contagion, weakens the body, which therefore becomes more vulnerable, and thus more likely to be contaminated by disease. This is even more the case if a sudden death strikes the imagination, or if one's relationship with the deceased had been tumultuous. However, Hans' conclusions on the case may come as a surprise.
If we may be permitted to give our opinion here, we would advise against all remedies which reek of superstition. The best remedy seemed to us to be the frank and unvarnished reconciliation with the dying and the forgetting of the past. This way, the dead are soothed, sleep peacefully, and no longer desire anything from life. Their imagination remains dormant, and as the course ceases, it never again becomes operative on the living. Moreover, if this were not enough to prevent it, and if an event still occurs that has something to do with the phenomenon mentioned, then it will be wise to ignore it. For any disturbance of the mind is food for the magical operation. But in case of failure, the best way will be, in the end, to exhume the body and destroy its harmful operation by destroying it by whatever means.
I see. So it seems rather clear that Rampft is not thinking about a solely psychological explanation.
Indeed not. Taking up, amongst others, Paracelsus' theories, Rampft believed that our bodies could act on other bodies by natural magic. That is, using the fact that spirit or soul aside, we all came from the same divine living matter. Hence, especially with impressionable people, witchcraft or mortuary curses were possible only by stimulating a body antipathy, which could go on even after death, until the total destruction of the antipathetic body. Therefore, though this might come as a surprise from a text belonging to the Enlightenment, Rampf's conclusion is that the impalement, beheading or burning of the incriminated body actually help the imagination to better resist these forms of natural magic, and thus infection by the plague.
That's fascinating, and definitely not the conclusion I would have expected. In a way, the ritual surrounding the banishment of the vampire thus becomes a sort of proxy for fighting the plague. Really fascinating. I wonder, Anton, what do you think about Rampf's conclusions in light of our current COVID-19 crisis?
At first glance, it seems far removed from our realities, or rather reality as we experience it, or even better, as we think we experience it. We no longer bury at a crossroads the dead whom we consider dangerous. We no longer drive a stake through their heart, cut their head off, nor burn them. But we are not completely foreign to the phenomena that Hans studied. One of the things the COVID showed us is that, despite the extraordinary advance of our science, in practice we still have relatively little control over a virus. To come to terms with this realization and establish some form of control over this new reality, we too have relied on myth. By which I mean ways to organize symbolically the world in order for it to make sense, or at least more sense. I use it here as Roland Barthes' notion. Now, with COVID, this involves conspiracy theories and xenophobia, but also over-mathematization, by which I mean early modeling predictions without sufficient statistical data, and we've seen a lot. Assertions devoid of foundation or method, including from among health professionals. Gestures also that can be fundamental, but that are sometimes incoherent and quasi-magical. And also a judgmental urge towards control of society, and not only at the level of the powers that be. If I learned something from my research in history of medicine, it's that no one, including the most educated, is safe from myth, especially when fear of death is at play. Does part of what I am doing to protect myself actually fall under the category of magical thought? That would be, for instance, an interesting question to ponder. As we experience a fear of an epidemic in the 21st century, my impression is that Rampf's vampires are both very distant and very close.
Thank you once again to Anton Serdecny for this fascinating conversation about epidemics and vampires. I have to say, since we recorded this interview a month or so ago, I have been reflecting on the forms of magical thinking that I myself have taken part in, I mean, at least since the start of the COVID crisis. Thank you also to my colleague, Gaspar Jakovac, for reading the excerpts from Michael Rampf's book. Finally, thank you so much to all those who have tuned in for our fifth episode. You make this work worthwhile. And, as always, if you like what you have heard, tune in 2 weeks when EUI researcher Tomas Tassinari talks to us about indigenous Brazilian populations, the Jesuits, and disease. Till next time, stay safe.